Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. Today, we are going to get into it with Candace, and I'm going to talk to her about something that I've never, ever sat down and talked to anybody about before. And it's the idea of dealing with a stalker. It's a word we throw around a lot, but Candace has been dealing with this for 23 years. Think about that for a second. Like dealing with a legitimate stalker for more than two decades of your life, what that means to always be looking over your shoulder, to always be wondering, that toll has got to be unbelievable to take on. And I'm excited, and I hope you understand why I'm using that word. I'm excited to get into this because I think there's a lot of people that deal with this situation and they probably feel very alone. They probably don't feel encouraged to talk about it. It seems to me like it would be really scary territory to even bring it up. But I'm glad she's here, and I'm glad she's going to tell her story today so that somebody else out there will feel less alone, will be encouraged to talk about it themselves. And then, as we always say here, I learned from people who lived it. When you're ready, share your story with us, okay? Before we get into it, I just want to talk to you for a moment about our grief relief retreats. If you are at least 6 months out from the loss of somebody you've loved, we would love an opportunity to put you into a day of healing. A day of healing that starts with breath work and movement and journaling and an equine therapy session, a beautiful river ceremony, community, a beautiful meal and a campfire and nature. It's just a remarkable day of healing. And I know firsthand, after losing my father, oh man, just the toll that grief can take on you, the toll it can take on your family. And if somebody is willing to raise their hand and say, I need a little bit of help here, I need some tools, that spillover effect for everybody around you is going to be pretty profound. So far, we are a perfect 10 out of 10 stars for everybody that has gone through our retreat, and we invite you to join us on March 23rd. You can get all the details, including location, pricing, all of that in the show notes right now. If you just click wherever you get your podcast, you open up the little show more there, and you will see a link to the Grief Relief Retreat, and we hope that you will really think about participating in our upcoming retreat in Scottsdale at the end of March. All right, let's jump into it today with Candace on this episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
I'm Candace, and I'm 40 years old.
Hey, Candace, what story are you here to share today?
Today, I'm here to share my story. I am a survivor of a stalker for over 23 years now, and I'm here to share my experiences with the trauma I've been through and the healing process and the therapies and the treatments I've gone through.
Wow. Who do you hope hears this?
I really hope anyone who's gone through a similar situation as me, particularly crime victims, victims of domestic violence, and anyone who's gone through prolonged trauma.
Here's it. Absolutely. Well, welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. I am eagerly awaiting this conversation because this is one of those words that we toss around a lot in our society. Oh, you're such a stalker. You're a stalker. You're a stalker. I mean, we hear that all the time. And it's almost like narcissism, right? Like most of the people who we call narcissists aren't, because the statistics tell us that like literally 1-2% of the population is. And I wonder what the statistics are like for stalkers in general. And for the purposes of this conversation, Candace, I pulled up the definition of stalking. So says the Department of Justice. And so here's what they say. Stalking is a pattern of repeated and unwanted attention, harassment, contact, or any other course of conduct directed at a specific person that would cause a reasonable person to feel fear. Yes. Now, you met this gentleman, I'm assuming it's a man?
Yes.
Who would become your stalker when? How old were you when you guys met?
I was 16. I was in high school. And wow. We briefly dated, I'm talking a few months, and some things happened, you know, normal kind of teenage breakup kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I broke it off with him. And he just has not left me alone ever since.
Okay, so we're going to get into all of that. As you guys know here on Learn From People Who Lived It, I really like to start with the first 10 years of people's lives because it really does help us understand how you got to the place that you're in. And so when you think back to 0 to 10 from you, Candace, help our audience understand what your life was like growing up.
My life from 0 to 10 was a typical average childhood. I had two loving parents growing up. They were married for over 40 years, so they were never divorced or anything like that. I did normal. We were a middle class, average family, just typical. But with that being said, I did go through some traumatic events in my childhood. Mm. So I bring that up just because when we get to the EMDR discussion, a lot of that came up through my EMDR therapy, and I didn't realize just how much that affects us as adults.
I can't wait to talk about this. EMDR is one of those things that I've never given it a shot before, but for the people that have done it, they just swear by it. And there's so many positive aspects to it. And so I know that that's where we're going to go in a little bit. When you say, like, you know, I had a couple little dings on the way from 0 to 10, what kind of dings are you talking about?
Well, when I was between the ages of 2 and 3, I was sexually molested by a babysitter. And I was too young to testify. So, you know, the police, and there was an investigation and all of that. But, you know, a 3-year-old cannot get up on a stand and say what happened to them credibly. So, I don't remember a lot of that. So I really walked around my adult life knowing that it happened to me, but not thinking, because I didn't remember it, that it affected me. And I was very wrong.
Interesting. Did you, like so many other people, have this experience and not really talk about it? Or were you vocal with your parents? And if so, what was their reaction to it? I mean, I have my own kids. Maybe you do too. If a babysitter did that to my kids, it would be game over.
Right. I mean, I was too young to really express what was going on. And I didn't, you know, at 2-3 years old, you don't know, you know, you're so little. And so they knew something was wrong, which is why they contacted the police, which is why they figured out what had been going on. But, you know, later in my life, I guess, growing up in my childhood, I knew that it happened, but it wasn't ever something that came up for me or that I talked about a lot to anybody. I guess I had no reason to think that I did. But there was a lot of fears and anxiety that stemmed from that experience. Like, I became deathly afraid of water. And it was because this babysitter was giving me baths, which my parents did not give them an okay to do. They didn't realize it was happening at first. But, you know, later when I developed this insane fear of being in like a swimming pool, which should be a fun experience for any toddler, young child, it was not for me. And I had to go through many private swimming lessons with someone that would be patient and desensitize me, essentially. So it was, you know, those experiences that I lived as a child that I just never thought. I really just never even contributed it to anything that I was dealing with as an adult.
Wow. I don't talk about this very much, but I had a similar experience growing up. I had a babysitter who crossed the line with me on more than one occasion. I've since, you know, gone to many years of therapy to sort of sort that all out and figure out how, and it's crazy, right? Like, you have this experience as a little kid, and you're not even really sure all the different ways that it's going to show up in your life, but it does. It shows up in all these nooks and crannies and places, like, even when you're around good people, you can't give them the benefit of the doubt. It just makes it so hard to communicate, to feel, to allow yourself to feel. And it is a really, really strange thing to have something happen to you when you're so young, especially sexually, and because you can't even wrap your head around, you know, what's happening and what it all means and what does it mean for you. And so I'm wondering, Candace, as you got a little bit older, as you got to be, you know, 10, 12, 14, 16, into some of these years where, you know, you start dating, you kiss a boy, you start making out with people, right? Like these things happen for all of us as we get about in our dating world. Was that harder for you? Was it something that you had to think about, or how did it show up for you?
I think the biggest thing was I struggled to trust people just in general. And of course, you know, I look back on it now and going through all the therapy and treatments that I've gone through, it's like, wow, how did I even trust anybody? So there was, you know, it was always kind of a feeling that I had walked around with as a child with a lot of anxiety of just not feeling safe and not feeling ever okay. So it was difficult. I mean, I look back and I wish that I had the treatments and the therapy available to me back then, because I feel like my life would have been so different. But I am just grateful that I finally got to this place in my life where I've been able to process a lot of that. And there's just such relief on the other side of it. And that's really my message that I want to get across to people.
There's so much freedom waiting on the other side. It really is. It's not just something I say on almost every podcast, but when you hit these things head on and you start to deal with the events that took place, because here's the thing about this kind of trauma that you experienced, that I experienced, and millions of other people have experienced, is that it never really goes away fully. It's kind of always in the back of your mind. And for people who are thinking about doing the work on themselves and working through some of these things, I feel the need to just say, like, doing the work means that while it continues to show up for the rest of your life, you get better and better at managing the feelings and emotions. So you mentioned anxiety would come up around these kind of situations, relationships, dating, intimacy, that kind of a stuff. I experienced the exact same thing. Really anxious feelings when I got into those moments. And, you know, the psychiatrist who we've had on the show 100 times, Dr. David Lykin, he's really clear about it. He says, when these things happen to us, they go on our permanent record. It's like etching in a vinyl record. And so it's always going to be there. The key is to learn to live with the sound of your record and figure out how you're going to cycle through that. And so before we move on to the stalking and the EMDR and some of this stuff, what did you learn through your own therapies that helped you manage that early childhood sexual abuse?
You mean like coping strategies?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Give me a couple of tools or some really neat thing that you picked up that's been very useful.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest things I think that has made such a difference in my anxiety is meditation. Yes. Incorporating that on a daily basis and making the time for it, it's been life-altering for me. I was on antidepressants for years. Yeah. I was on anti-anxiety medicines at times. And I'm not saying there's not a place for that, but to get to a place where I can self-regulate, where I can keep the anxiety at a manageable place where I don't feel like I'm dependent on any substance, any one external thing. It's been life-changing. It's just been pretty amazing. I'm able to function. You get so in tune to your body when you meditate and you become way familiar with those uncomfortable emotions and feelings and triggers that come up, and knowing how to manage those is just, it's life-changing.
Yeah. I'm a meditation freak myself. And so I love talking about this. What kind of a meditation do you practice?
I've done guided. I've done, just, you know, trying to sit in the quiet. It's really hard for people because, you know, I get it. And I was very resistant to meditation when I was younger. And thinking back on it now, it's like, well, no wonder. Who wants to sit with their thoughts, especially when you've got all of your limiting beliefs and the anxious thoughts that just kind of take over for so many people.
I know you've done the work. I can hear it in your language. Yeah. This idea of the limited beliefs, that's such a strong thing for people to key into. Yeah. In fact, almost all of us could use a therapist just to work on that piece alone, because you don't have to experience any kind of trauma or any of that crap to have these limited beliefs that put this, I don't know what it is, you'd call it, this wall up around you about what you're going to do and be.
Right.
For folks who want to start a meditation, we should tell them up front that it's hard. It's hard to get started. It's like going to the gym. Like, you can't just walk into the gym and start bench pressing 300 pounds like that.
Right.
You got to work up to it.
It takes a lot of practice. And I just started really small. I'm like, okay, I'm going to sit here for a minute.
Yes.
I'm going to sit here for 30 seconds. Whatever I can do. And then I just built that up to 5 minutes turned into 10 minutes, 10 minutes turned into 15, and so on and so forth. But there's just so much relief from it that I just wish I could like tell the world, and you know, like it's life changing. So
here's how I put it to people. I've done a lot of drugs in my life, and there is nothing that makes me feel like a freaking great meditation makes me feel. Nothing. Yes. Nothing.
Right. Yeah. And it's pretty amazing. You know, I can be in a bad mood, or something could trigger me that makes me angry or whatever. And if I just go into a meditation and just sit with it, it passes very quickly. And it's finding that awareness and that power of being able to like realize that you do have that control, that power inside of you. You don't need to look for external factors to make yourself feel better.
I love it. You guys, you've been here for 15 minutes on this podcast, and you've already picked up so many great tools from Candace. I mean, what she is saying should be and is, quite frankly, in every book in the world on meditation. Slow, gentle, work up to it. Use it as one of your tools when you start to get riled up and fired up. You know, I mean, I've been meditating for almost 10 or 11 years now. And my family knows, like, I'm going to say, hey guys, I need to go have a sit. And they leave me alone. I go sit in my room or my office or outside or wherever I'm going to go. And I genuinely feel better after it's done. Let's start to walk towards the main reason you showed up today, which is to talk about EMDR and how that's helped you through this episode of stalking. You mentioned up front that you met this person at 16 years old. And so, you know, let's think about that. You're in high school, sophomore or junior, something like that, right? And you guys date for a few months. And then, like every teenage relationship, or 99.9% of them, it ends. It dissolves. And for one reason or the other, you guys decide that this isn't going to work out for you. How quickly after that breakup does he start to show you this sign of like, I'm not willing to let go yet? And walk us through how he displayed, I'm not ready to walk away yet.
It was pretty immediate after I tried to break things off. Okay. I remember him just calling incessantly, calling the house phone over and over and over again, making threats. It was nonstop. And, you know, I tried to ignore it for a while. I eventually had to go file for a restraining order because the police could not do anything without that piece of paper. So it's been a difficult thing throughout the years, knowing exactly how to navigate the criminal justice system when it comes to this. There's not a lot of support or understanding for victims of stalking, at least that I've run into. And I hope that over the years, it's gotten better with more education and more just understanding of how somebody operates, that who does stalk other people or harass. It's all about power. It's all about control. This particular individual is severely mentally ill. He has progressively gotten worse over the years. But I've had a lot of people ask me, like, why would you even date anybody like this? And it was not like that when I was 16. He wasn't.
I mean, what a useless question to ask somebody, right? I mean, right. Like in the world of useless questions, when it's all said and done, why did you do that is like the most useless thing on planet Earth.
Right. Yeah. And if anybody had a crystal ball that they could see the future, I mean, I don't think anybody would choose it is a very useless question. But there's I've gotten a lot of that kind of response from a lot of people and a lot of victim blaming, like, what did you do to this guy? Like, what did you, and it's just, and that's, the other reason I want to kind of like talk about my experiences, because I know there's a lot of other people experiencing something similar to this. I know my story is a little unique in terms of the years that I've had to deal with this, but I know the feeling when someone is making you uncomfortable, you don't feel safe in your own space. And the last thing you need in that moment is someone questioning you as if you had something, if you had some part of going through this particular situation with somebody that's, mentally unstable.
That's it. That's the key. What was the reaction of the people around you, your family, mom and dad, friends? I'm wondering if, did you go to the same high school with this person so that you had to see each other in the hallways and that kind of a thing? So let's start at the first question, which is, what is the reaction of the people in your immediate family and your friend group as you start to say, hey, mom, dad, this guy won't leave me alone? I mean, they must know that, because we're talking, 23 years ago. So yeah, I mean, they had to call the house phone. Right. I mean, what did your mom and dad think about all this?
I mean, they were concerned. This was not a typical response. I think there's sometimes when there are breakups, especially with the teenage years, there can be heightened emotions. There can be a lot of dramatics, for lack of a better word.
Sure.
And I think we all really thought and assumed that eventually this would die down and he would disappear and this would never be another issue. But I think it was pretty quickly after this, all of it started, that we kind of realized, like, this is another level of not wanting to accept no. So, I mean, that's when the really violent threats started. And
like, when you say violent threats, is he like threatening to kill you? Is he threatening to do like, he is.
Yeah. I mean, and he told my father on the phone in explicit graphic detail how he was going to kill me, he was going to do with my body. So, I mean, it was more than just phone calls. It was more than just, he sent letters over the years. He showed up just randomly once, didn't ring the doorbell, but one of the neighbors luckily called the cops to report a suspicious person because he was looking in the windows and that sort of thing. So, it just escalated over time. Like, this is another level of dangerous. This is not just somebody harassing me anymore. Like, this is stalking. And it's very difficult to convict somebody of stalking because it's hard to get the evidence and you have to have enough of it to convince a judge to enforce, the maximum penalty. So it took me about 10 years to get the stalking conviction.
Wow. Okay. So, I have so many questions. I just don't even know where to start, but I'm going to just go start where I may here, which is, I have to imagine your parents must have been enraged by all of this. And then on that same note, I can't even imagine the varied emotions that you went through as a young girl who's still developing, right? Like, you're 16, 17, 18 years old. Your brain is still putting the pieces together. I mean, you had to be equal parts angry, equal parts what's wrong with me, equal parts I don't want to do this anymore. Equal parts, I want to kill this guy. Like, I just imagine all of these things must have been swimming around in your head. Who, did you have somebody in your life that you could lean on and talk these things through?
Yeah, I mean, I have a very supportive family. We're all very close, and they've always, you know, been there to support me the best that they can. I've also had and continued to have very close friendships with a lot of, you know, really important people in my life that have certainly given me the support that I needed at times. So, but yeah, I mean, the emotions that you go through when something crazy like this happens and you're trying to make sense of it and you're trying to figure out what's the next best step, like I have to keep myself safe, but I don't want to give this person the power to control what I do, where I go, that sort of thing. So it's always been a real balance of safety versus taking my power back.
Can you go anywhere?
Yes.
Anywhere without thinking about the possibility that this person shows up?
Yeah. I mean, it's gotten better over the years. And I think a lot of that is a result of the therapy and the trauma stuff that I've gone through, the EMDR. I think all of that's helped tremendously because before I did all that, I could still function, but I would easily get triggered. I would get a phone call from, you know, a probation officer or anything related to anything having to do with this person. And it would just send me into like just a full on anxiety, panic attacks, the PTSD stuff. I mean, it's just, it was pretty awful.
Can't even imagine. Okay. Now I have maybe some more direct questions that might help somebody else. You know, the podcast is appropriately titled Learn From People Who Lived It. So we have an opportunity to learn from you who's been through this. Is some other young boy or girl that's going through this same kind of a thing? In your opinion, what starts to separate like just a crazy ex-boyfriend or a crazy ex-girlfriend from a stalker? Were there a few things that developed that you can help us understand where the shift comes in?
I think it was when I truly started feeling unsafe. Okay. Because I think at first I assumed, like most people would, that this will die down. This won't, you know, this will fizzle out eventually, as the majority of those kind of situations do. But there were red flags, you know, he showed a lot of controlling behavior from the very beginning. And I was young and naive and I didn't know. But, you know, there's signs that I think if I had known at that age that I probably would have not continue to date this person any longer than I did, even though it was a relatively short period of time in my life. It's just those signs of like controlling behavior and not normal reactions to having other male friends and it being like a big deal. I mean,
jealousy.
Yeah. Like unhealthy behaviors like that. And I know some of that's normal with teenage stuff. I mean, it's normal to feel jealousy. But this was, like I said, it was another level. And I think I picked up on that pretty quickly, but I just wish I could go back and know what I know now. And just
because don't you want to say to every young girl listening, like that jealousy, that isn't him loving you. That isn't him really care. He just really cares about me. It's none of that crap. He is in this thing to control you. And the moment he does not have that control, that is when the shit hits the fan. Like that is how these situations work.
Right. And it's true. Even, you know, later in life, I found myself in another, it was, I would say, abusive relationship, not so much the stalking and harassment stuff, but the control, the power.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I went through the therapy that I went through and I learned what those red flags look like. And I learned what true love, you know, like actually loving and caring about someone looks like. It's not the power and control you have over other people, you know? And it's, I think in our society, we're so like, people are so desperate to feel loved by this some external, whether it's another person right. or so it's really kind of bringing it back to yourself and learning how to give that to yourself and not seeking it in external places and giving that power to anybody that's, you know, displaying those red yeah. flags that they call, you know.
Yeah, well said. What's in place right now for folks who are experiencing stalkers? You mentioned earlier, like the, you know, the justice system and just trying to navigate that and it taking 10 years to get this thing done. And, you know, now I understand that this individual is behind bars again for right. this behavior. So what are good first steps for, and what were your first steps to start to make this like legal, start putting this stuff on paper, start documenting it, start reporting it to the police? Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Right. So the biggest thing is you just evidence, keep a log. If someone's calling you incessantly, you write down, you know, the times that they're calling you. I mean, and now technology is so different. This was, you know, 20 years ago, I had to write it all down. I didn't have a cell phone I could screenshot, but now there are a lot of other ways that you can document it. But evidence is everything. You know, we put up cameras around our house that was able to get him on camera. The evidence is the biggest thing because that is what they can use to convict somebody of this particular crime. And eventually I accepted help. It was actually one of his old probation officers that asked me if I wanted any therapy services. And honestly, I was very skeptical. I didn't think I had been through therapy before. And I just kind of assumed, well, this is like free through the government. How good can it be? And I was very wrong. And I just want people to know that there are services out there available, and I am living proof that it, you know, it works. And
yeah, choose them. Right. Yes. That's you, when you go through difficult things in your life, the only way you lose is when you stop trying. So
right.
just keep moving. Try if one therapy doesn't work, move on to another. If you go to the therapist and you can't stand the look of them, pick another one. If you try a medication and it doesn't work, pick another one. If you try meditation and you have a hard time with breath work, go with a guided meditation. Like you just only lose when you stop enlisting in these services. When you get to a point where like you have to stand up in a courtroom and literally put somebody in prison because they won't leave you alone. Holy hell, what kind of emotions are going through you as you're doing that? Are you trying to stay like cool and calm so the judge doesn't think like you're as off your rocker as this guy is? Like, it just seems like it would be such a mind F.
Yeah, I mean, it is essentially. I have felt pretty much every emotion you can feel. How do you not in that situation?
Right.
And, you know, even though I have gotten so far in my therapy and EMDR and everything, I still have moments, you know, if I have to do anything court related, it's still triggering. How is it not? I'm just better prepared at this point to handle those emotions in a much better way. You know, the Arizona laws changed around orders of protection. It used to be every year you would have to renew it, and now it's every 2 years. So it's progress, but really in my situation, they just came out with a new injunction against harassment, but it's a lifetime injunction. So like if somebody committed a horrible crime and they needed protection from this person forever, then this piece of paper could be in place to protect that person and not have to be re-victimized. Unfortunately, stalking did not make that list of, there's quite an extensive list of crimes, particularly like sexual in nature against children, and some other pretty horrible crimes, but stalking is not on there. So I was not eligible to get that against this person. And everyone asks me, how is that even possible? And right. it's just a part of our criminal justice system. So, you know, I've made it, I feel like, you know, part of my purpose is in going forward, doing whatever I can so that other people are not in this situation where, you know, okay, I have 2 years now, but in, you know, another year, if I want that protection, I have to go back to court, get that piece of paper from a judge that says this person has to leave me alone. But he figured out that he could contest it. And in the first time in 20 years, he contested the last one. So I was forced to talk to this person in court. I was forced to. I had to answer his questions when he tried to say that, I mean, it was a control thing, obviously. But I was forced to do that. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. Talk to this person, you know, directly. I just think it's wrong for victims of crime to be re-traumatized, you know, especially with this kind of history. It's mind blowing to me.
Wow. Okay. We're aware now what's happened. And I think people understand the magnitude of the situation. Now, if you guys know anything about me in this podcast, it's about, okay, I had the thing happen to me. What am I going to do so this isn't the story for the rest of my life? And how can I cycle through this? What can I do? We talk about tools a lot. You already mentioned one of them, which is amazing, meditation. I encourage everybody to look into it. You land on EMDR. Now, explain to folks who have maybe heard that acronym before what it is and how that therapy works.
Yeah. So EMDR, it stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So one of the misconceptions about EMDR is that it's talk therapy, and it's not. It's going over the traumatic memories, but you're processing the emotion, the feeling behind it, so that you hopefully don't get triggered in the future. I don't exactly understand how it works. It's basically, it's a form of psychotherapy, and it involves like moving your eyes in a specific way. It's the way that my therapist did it with me was she held up two fingers and she'd basically activate whatever traumatic memory we were working on. And she'd move her, you know, her two fingers in front of my face, and I would just follow them, and it would be in sets of, I'm not sure how many, I never counted. But it's just this way it somehow processes that traumatic memory that is so triggering. And basically, we just do that with the memory until that triggering emotion, that feeling would come up when it was brought up. So, and, you know, with all the trauma that I've gone through in my life, it was like peeling away the onion or the layers of an onion, essentially. And, you know, like processing one traumatic memory often brought up another thing that I forgot or blocked out at some point. And I've been doing it for about 2 years now, and I'm still doing it. But the relief that has come from it is just like, wow, more people should know about this. More people should have access to it. It's just pretty amazing. I did not expect to have this kind of life-changing experience.
Tell me about your first experience
with EMDR. I was pretty nervous, actually, because I didn't know what to expect.
Right.
My therapist was really great at walking me through the steps. She taught me all kind of self-regulating tools and techniques. So she said, if it gets too much, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And some of those tools are things that I do just every day. You know, if I feel myself getting triggered or if my anxiety goes up, it's just having those self-regulating those emotions. So,
yeah. Do you cry? Is it, do you shake? Is there a physical reaction when you're processing these thoughts, feelings, and emotions?
There have been a few memories that I processed and I cried through the whole thing. And then there were other ones that I didn't have that reaction to. And there were some that I thought, oh, this shouldn't take very long. And then it took me twice as long and it brought out all these other emotions and, you know, things that I just did not expect. So it's kind of a roller coaster, but it's just like I keep saying, the relief on the other side of it and just thinking about certain things and not feeling all those negative emotions and repressing them is that's where the work is.
Cause I, like so many of us, you know, when we have something happen to us, we become emotion stuffers and we think like, you know, I'll just stuff this down and it won't show its face. I'm putting that all in air quotes. It won't ever show up. I'll just keep stuffing and stuffing and stuffing. And it's not a long-term strategy because eventually you're going to have to deal with it or everybody else in your life will pay for it, including yourself. So what have you learned about you through EMDR?
Just
that's a loaded question. Good luck.
Yeah. the biggest thing is that, you know, I think the awareness, the self-awareness that came from going through this process, I walked around in fight or flight mode for pretty much my entire adult life. And I thought that was normal. I thought that's how everybody felt. I just had that assumption. I think I felt it for so long that it just was normal to me. And it manifested in certain ways, though. Like I had a health condition that came up in my late 20s, early 30s, and it was my autonomic nervous system not functioning properly. And I went to several specialists, I went through all the doctor's visits, all that, and nobody, not once, did a doctor bring up trauma to me. That this could be
interesting. We're getting better about that now. I think we're starting to look there a little quicker, but we're still not there.
Right. And that was the biggest eye-opening. The first person actually that brought it to my attention was the first time I saw a naturopathic doctor.
Yes.
And she took my extensive history and all the trauma and then she looked at all my symptoms and she was like, you know, this is most likely caused from all this stuff you've gone through and it's kind of still there. So, and then it was shortly a few years after that, that I was connected with the therapist that I'm with currently. And she said the same thing. She said she took my history and all the symptoms and my medical stuff. And she was like, I think a lot of this can be relieved. It'll be interesting to see. And shockingly, I still have some symptoms sometimes, but it's nothing like it was. Like I couldn't drive for a long time. I kept having like fainting spells and nobody could figure out what was wrong with me. So it's very interesting to me and crazy that, you know, our medical system is not, they don't ask you how your mental health is when you go in for a, you know, just a regular checkup. It's more science-based, you know, like, It's not like, what did you deal with the last 10 years of your life? You know, what are you carrying around? What's your emotional baggage like? It's nothing like that. Like you said,
doctors should steal the learn from people who lived it model, which is tell me about 0 to 10. Let me get caught up on how it started for you. Honestly, they really should be starting with that question with so many people. And I know we're getting better about it, but you know, then there's this thing of like, okay, so I got to deal with it. Now what? And, you know, what does that mean for me? Because now you have to, like anybody who's been through it, doesn't matter if it's your fault or not, there are a certain set of belief systems that get set up in us when we go through experiences like this that you have to learn how to unwire and unravel. And it sucks. It's no fun to look that deep within. And not that I'm saying you had a hand in this, but because you went through it, you had some belief systems that you, you know, kind of made to be true about yourself. And so I'm wondering if you can help us understand what were those belief systems for you? And I'll give you an example so you can get your head around this. So most of the people who listen to Learn From People Who Lived It know that when I was 23, my father dropped dead of a heart attack in front of me, and I tried to save his life, and I couldn't. And what happened for me in that moment was a whole set of belief systems got set up that said, you don't know enough, and you're not useful. And so you go, and again, that wasn't my fault. I'm not a cardiologist. There's nothing I could have done to save my dad's life in that moment. The finest, Dr. Todd Hurst, who I work with now, he's one of the finest cardiologists in all of planet Earth. He could not have saved my dad that day. Doesn't matter. The belief system still got set up within me. And for years, I operated underneath that principle of like, you're not smart enough and you're not useful. And it didn't show up all the time, but it showed up enough, and it had a tendency to show up in those moments that I'd really rather it not show up. So I'm wondering if you can articulate the belief system that got set up in you surrounding this event. Like, what kinds of things did you believe about yourself that you know aren't true and they're not your fault, but doesn't matter. The experience happened, now they're here, and now we got to deal with it. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the biggest beliefs that I think I've walked around and carried with this particular situation that I've gone through was not being safe. Like, I never felt safe. And I think some of that stemmed from the stuff that I went through as a child. But it seemed to be a repeating theme in my life. Yeah. And then, you know, through the therapy, it's like we uncovered a lot of that. And then also just not feeling enough, not feeling like I'm worthy for, you know, someone to treat me the way that I deserve to be treated and not this power control abuse. And I mean, I think, like you said, we are programmed to believe certain things, and, you know, things happen to us when we're younger and those instill those beliefs in us. And it's so difficult as an adult to dig deep and get to the root of those limiting beliefs and challenge them to,
there you go,
you know, reprogram your brain essentially, because, you know, if you keep telling yourself something, of course you're going to believe it. So it's not easy. I understand why people shy away from therapy. I understand why people don't want to do it, because it sucks and it hurts, and getting down to that raw emotion, it's
yeah, face right there.
Yeah. It is not an easy journey, but you don't stay in that place. You know, yeah. The more open you are to embracing it and saying yes to it, that's what my therapist taught me, is say yes to the emotion, say yes to the feeling.
Yes.
Even if it's bad, or it's negative, you know, it's not a good feeling, you say yes to it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you know, you talk about like, I didn't feel worthy, I didn't feel safe. And I say to my audience, everybody listening to us right now, imagine operating your life from a place of, I don't ever feel safe. Like, think about all the different ways that that's going to impact a person. You can't even go to school. You can't even go to the grocery store. You can't even go out with your girlfriends to a movie. Like, you can't even go to church. There are a million different applications to this idea of, I don't feel safe. And you mentioned this earlier, that you spent so much of your life in that fight or flight, right? In the back part of our brain, that's beautiful, and it keeps us alive in times of danger. It's absolutely necessary. But we also have to switch it off, because as I say to people, going to the grocery store is not a life or death experience. Going to church isn't a life or death experience, right? Going to the movies, these are not life and death situations for most of us. And you can imagine all the different ways that I don't feel safe would show up. Like, how could anybody show up 100% in a relationship, even a good one, if the wall is up that, well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's kind of like you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop, is how my friend Teresa explains it. And then this idea of, I'm not worthy. We think about all the times where any one of us have had this experience before, where you didn't feel like you were enough, or you were, yeah, that's the best way to put it. You just didn't feel like you were enough. you think about all the different ways that's going to show up for you in your life and how you're going to be around other people, and that lack of confidence and that the lack of self-value and worth and self-esteem and all these things that we talk a lot about now, they're not present because you just don't feel worthy. And when you don't feel worthy, you're going to let the wrong people in. You're going to require more outside influence to fill your bucket because you're not sure how to do that yourself. And you mentioned like self-regulation. I need to love myself so that I can love other people. I mean, these are all really profound things that you've discovered through years of therapy, and I'm guessing the last couple of years in EMDR. I want to go back to EMDR for just a second. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest revelation that you've had since starting EMDR? Is there something that was like a light bulb, aha moment for you at all?
I think mainly it was the self-awareness that I gained. It was almost like not quite an out-of-body experience, but kind of reflecting on like, wow, how did I function? You know, when you realize what's happening in your body when you're in fight or flight, and obviously the triggers, the emotions, all that stuff that are going in that moment, and you can't think clearly. I look back and I was just like, wow, I don't know how I functioned. And I think people do it probably more than I'm assuming happens. I think a lot of people probably feel the way I did, you know, like this is just normal. This is just how humans feel their emotions, and it's so not. And I think that was the biggest light bulb for me, was like, wow, this is, and I think that's what's caused it to be the most life-changing thing that I've ever experienced, is the self-awareness that came from it, and then learning how, being more in tune with my body and learning the things that have helped me so that I don't walk around in fight or flight all the time. You know, I still get triggered. Like I said, I'm still human. This is a process. It's not like I'm completely healed and everything's great. And especially right. Since I'm still dealing with it on some level. But it's a process. And I'm just so grateful that I've been able to get to the point that I've gotten to. And, you know, my therapist has to remind me sometimes, like if I get really discouraged or overwhelmed, she's like, you need to look at how far you've come, like the Candace that you are now compared to the Candace before you did an EMDR treatment. And so that kind of brings me back to, wow, this has been an amazing experience. And I just wish more people were aware of it. I wish more people had access to it.
It's totally that. I remember going through my healing journey, and then like after that session, you walk around and you like, you want to gift it to every single person you know. You're like, you need this, you need this, you need this, you right. need this, you need this. Like everybody should try this. And I want to echo something that Candace just said a second ago, which is most of us spend our lives in survival mode. And that's kind of what you are articulating there. We just, every day isn't about being alive and really living. It's about surviving and just getting through the day. And you just operate different when you're in survival mode. And nobody gets the best version of you. Not your mom, not your dad, not your brother, not your sister, not your spouse, not your kids. But here's the part that you need to give a shit about a lot. Not even you get the best version of yourself. And until you have that revelation, the light bulb goes on about how critical that is to your growth, spiritually, mentally, physically, you sort of just walk around not knowing. And that's what is so unfortunate. Like so many people just don't understand how, if they would just pour into themselves, get some therapies, find something that works, man, they would be so much better for all those other people. But most importantly, they would be so much better for themselves. Their value would go way up. Their esteem would go way up. Their confidence would go through the roof. And I'm imagining that you're at a stage in your growth process right now where, you know, I don't know if you're married now or if you've got a new family, but if you were to, now when you meet other people, you got a sixth sense about them and you really listen to it. You trust that voice now because you're confident, no?
Yes.
Yeah.
A big part of this was building my intuition up and trusting it.
Mm-hmm.
Trusting that gut feeling. If you know, it could be about anything, but trusting that inner gut feeling, if it is talking to you, listen to it. And meditation has certainly helped strengthen that for me. You know, I always doubted my intuition when I was younger, and I really wish I could go back and listen closer, because I think it's there to protect us. And I think if we can learn to listen to that part of us and tune into it, I think we are just better humans. And it's just that was another big part of, you know, when I went through the EMDR, a big part of that process was the meditation. It was, you know, something that my therapist was like, do this, you know, practice. And I was like, you know, at this point, I have nothing to lose. And you get to that point, I think a lot of people get to that point where you're just tired of like this. I don't want to live like this anymore. I don't want to wake up and just cringe at the thought of living each day. Like, I don't think we're meant to be here to do that. So I think it's, you know, getting to that place of like, I can do this and there is relief on the other side. It's just life changing.
I'll put it another way. Dr. David Lykan always says, you've already paid the tuition. Like, you've already gone through the hardest part of the experience. So now cash it in. You've already done all the hard work. The hard work was being around this guy, having to deal with this guy, the phone calls, the threats. You already paid the tuition. You've already gone through the hardest part of it. So now cash it in on yourself and start to move from a place. A serious question as we kind of wrap up, and I hope that you'll have the ability to answer me as honestly as you can. Will you ever truly feel safe again?
That's a really good question. It's a question that I've asked myself. And I think, yes, I do think I can feel safe at some point. I feel safe right now. And I think part of this whole experience for me is taking my power back, not letting this person dictate, you know, how I'm going to live my life and how I'm, you know, there's other victims that this person has gone after in the past, but I'm the only one that I guess I'm not so easy to just like, I'm not just going to move and run away. And, you know, it's something like, no, you don't get to, you know, if I'm going to move, it's going to be on my own accord. I don't want it to be because you're pushing me out. And yeah, a big part of this is just taking my power back. Obviously, I'm still doing what I can to be safe. And you know, and coming on this podcast and talking about this for the first time publicly, I think it's very empowering for me because I've not wanted to share because of, you know, of what could happen if he hears it or whatever, but it's, you know, it's part of my journey and part of the healing process. And I think what you've said on your past podcast episodes that I've listened to is that, you know, hurt people, but healed people can really heal people. So that's,
you walked me to exactly what I wanted to kind of wrap up with, which is that idea that I've come to understand. The only reason we go through difficult things is so that we can help other people when it's their turn. And you are doing that right now for somebody else. You are literally turning that light on for somebody else. Today, somebody will have heard our podcast and feel less alone. They will feel like, okay, maybe I should start talking about it. And then as we say at the close of every podcast, and then when you're ready, come on and share your story with us, because that's why we're here, to learn from people who've lived it. And I love the courage that you possess. I love the fact that you're grabbing a hold of this story, and it's at the end of the day, it really has nothing to do with this other person. It has everything to do with you and how you're going to continue to move through your life, right? Like you mentioned up front, you said you're in your 40s, correct? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of life left for you, girl. And, you know, it would be such a shame if this guy continued to hold all of that power over what your potential is. That would be, that's the worst thing that could happen, really, at the end of the day. And that's not going to happen because you have grabbed this thing by the horns. You're going to tell your story. And honestly, when we go through these things and we articulate our story for the first time, as I always tell people, we're not doing this so we can blast people on TMZ and we can air out all our dirty laundry. No, we're just done holding on to it. We're done with the power that this thing has and has had on us our whole lives. And we're just ready to set it down. And the only way to do that is to talk about it, is to use therapy to work through it. I mean, that's it. You have to go through it if you're going to move through it. And so the courage that you have displayed today hopefully speaks volumes to not just you, but to other people in your life. Like I guarantee people are going to, your friends are going to hear this podcast and you're going to get those badass high fives. Hey, that's a badass girl. Good job. Like that is what's happened here today, is that you have stepped into your true self a little bit more. And I would imagine that feels okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's empowering and, yeah. You know, I was a little nervous because I've never done anything like this, but it's certainly, very empowering. And I'm just so glad that I've been able to do it in a way that I feel comfortable and safe. Yeah. And thank you so much for providing that for me and, you know, leaving the shame at the door. Like you said, nice. Like we all have the stuff that we've been through and we're just kind of tired of, you know, not wanting to talk about it, but that's where it starts. That's where the healing begins, is talking about it.
Yeah, because people go through these things in the, like at least me, I'll speak for myself. I had a tendency to blame myself, even though there was nothing about that situation I could have changed or done differently or better. You're the same way, right? You probably spent some time blaming yourself, and then that's where the shame shows up, but that's so useless.
Right, and I don't know why as humans we do that so much. It's, you know, we go through these things and none of it is our fault, but somehow we turn it around to, like, oh my God, what did I do? Like, what could I have done differently? And it's like, no, wait, this is not helpful, you know, to blame. And I think part of that's just the stigma that's been around mental health for so long.
Yes,
and
for sure.
But you're breaking that. So thank you.
We're trying. You and I, one step at a time. That's how this works. Candace, I can't thank you enough for joining us today and learn from people who lived it. And thank I want to encourage anybody who's going through a situation like this, take the necessary steps. Like she said, start to document these things, take your screenshots, get the authorities involved if you need to. But most importantly, use the tools that are available to us, tools like meditation, tools like EMDR. You mentioned medication. All of these things can be useful for people, but I really want you to step into something starting today. Figure out what your next steps are going to be so that you can find your way out of this thing and literally just release the shackles of the event, because your life, and you and I have said it a number of different ways and a few times on this podcast, there is an enormous amount of freedom waiting for you on the other side of those conversations. And that's what I hope everybody takes away from today. Candace, stay super safe. We are so cheering for you. And what a beautiful soul to come on and be vulnerable and help our audience understand what this is all about. And hopefully you've done something real incredible today, which has empowered another young lady or young man to take the steps necessary to keep themselves safe and move on from that situation. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
We have three goals with Learn From People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word. Learn from people who lived it.
One of our proud resource partners is Eric's House. Here's the deal. Nothing quite prepares us for the heartache of a profound loss. And grief isn't a problem to be fixed, but rather a normal reaction to loss. So when somebody you love dies, it might feel like everything you once knew as true has changed. When we experience that loss, especially the ones that are really unexpected, like suicide or addiction, grief is complicated. That's where the community at Eric's House comes in. Link to them on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholived.com.